You're listening to WPTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jennifer Egan, whose new novel is titled Manhattan Beach. In the second hour of the show, I will air an interview from the archives with Vermont illustrator and author Sarah Dillard. First, we have our interview with Jennifer Egan, who was born in Chicago and raised in San Francisco. She's the author of The Invisible Circus, a novel which became a feature film starring Cameron Diaz in 2001. Look at Me, a finalist for the National Book Award in Fiction in 2001. Emerald City and Other Stories, and the best-selling The Keep. Her novel, A Visit from the Goon Squad, won the 2011 Pulitzer Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction, and the LA Times Book Prize. Her short stories have appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, Granta, McSweeney's, and other magazines. Her nonfiction articles appear frequently in the New York Times Magazine, and her new novel, Manhattan Beach, is just out, published by Scribner. Here's the publisher's description of the book, which was included on the long list for this year's National Book Award. Anna Carrigan, nearly 12 years old, accompanies her father to visit Dexter Stiles, a man who, she gleans, is crucial to the survival of her father and her family. She's mesmerized by the sea beyond the house and by some charged mystery between the two men. Years later, her father has disappeared and the country is at war. Anna works at the Brooklyn Naval Yard, where women are allowed to hold jobs that once belonged to men, now soldiers abroad. She becomes the first female diver, the most dangerous and exclusive of occupations, repairing the ships that will help America win the war. One evening at a nightclub, she meets Dexter Stiles again and begins to understand the complexity of her father's life, the reasons he might have vanished. With the atmosphere of a noir thriller, Egan's first historical novel follows Anna and Stiles into a world populated by gangsters, sailors, divers, bankers, and union men. Manhattan Beach is a deft, dazzling, propulsive exploration of a transformative moment in the lives and identities of women and men of America and the world. I spoke to Jennifer Egan last week, and I began, as you will hear, by asking her about writing historical fiction. I hope you enjoy our conversation. People are calling this your first historical novel, although I sort of feel like A Visit from the Goon Squad must have required a lot of historical research, too. But anyway, this feels more like a classic historical novel, and I just wondered how you found writing it from that light.
I found it really difficult. It was my hardest book to write, for sure. And I think the reason is that writing a book that, first of all, you're correct that other books have required a fair amount of research, not even so much Goon Squad, although I did have to learn more, I had to learn about the music industry, but right. My first novel, The Invisible Circus, involves radicalism in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s in Europe and in America, and I did do a fair amount of research for that, and that was sort of pre-internet, so in a way that was actually sitting in the library. But the thing that made this so challenging is that there are so many, it's not just that it's happening outside my lifetime, which already is very hard for me, I learned, because my entry point for fiction really is a time and a place. That's what I start with.
Okay.
So I don't use people that I know, and I start without a plot or characters. But the one point of reference that I usually have for everything that I write is a deep familiarity with the time and place. Mm-hmm. And, of course, writing about New York during World War II deprived me of that familiarity. So that was one challenge. But then even more, there are so many particular worlds in the book, and I think it's fair to say that I knew absolutely nothing about any of them.
Wow.
There's deep sea diving.
Yeah.
I've never even scuba dived.
Uh-huh.
There's the Merchant Marine. I have no experience with sailing or shipping. There's the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which is just a really sort of rich, you know, historical environment with a history dating back to the late 18th century. I knew not. I've lived several blocks away from it for years, and I didn't even know it was there until I heard about it. And then also, you know, organized crime, various factions of it, about which I knew nothing. So it felt sort of like I knew less than nothing. I didn't have the time and place that I usually use to anchor myself, and I was trying to write a story that seemed to be veering into worlds about which I knew nothing, and yet since I needed to write a first draft to even know what my plot would be or who would my characters would be, I felt very paralyzed in moments.
So in choosing this time and place, without a lot of background knowledge, what drew you to it? Like, why did you choose this time and place?
Well, again, it often doesn't feel like a choice exactly. I feel like I feel a kind of inclination towards something, and I don't really know why. So I can only, I guess the reason why in the moment is that it feels like an environment that will open out into something interesting.
Okay.
But why certain things feel that way to me, I'm not sure. I do think that I can guess at a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, I've lived here a long time, and I was here during 9/11 mm-hmm. when New York felt like a war zone for several months,
yeah.
and in a certain sense was. And I think that led me to naturally be curious about the last time that New York had been a war zone of sorts or felt like one. I mean, there was a great fear of invasion in New York during World War II. So I think that was one thing. I think also 9/11 felt like a really important step in the trajectory of American global superpower. I wasn't really sure what that step would mean, and I think we're still finding out the answer to that, the
yeah.
answers. But I think that the sense that an important move had happened led me to be curious about the initiation of that global power, what it felt like to know that it was amassing, and just revisiting that moment. So I think all of those things probably led me there. I had also long wanted to write a book about female power
yeah.
in one way or another. And I was, you know, my books tend to skew toward the male. I think partly because I don't write about myself, and I'm looking for ways to divide what I'm writing from myself. Writing from a male point of view is a very easy way to do that. But at the same time, I have this longstanding wish to write about female power, and somehow that era felt like a great one in which to explore it, because there were so many more strictures on female behavior than there are now.
Yeah.
And yet, because of the war, everything was sort of open to question.
Yeah.
And lives were changing. There was a lot of mobility suddenly. And so all of that felt like a really rich environment to explore.
Right. Rosie the Riveter and all of that.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about the female who is one of your point of view characters, and that's do you think of her as Anna or Anna?
Anna.
Anna. Okay. So early scenes in the book introduce us to Anna as a young girl. She's out on a business errand with her father, and they go to visit a man named Dexter Stiles, and her father becomes annoyed with her on this trip, and she worries that he might slap her, as he has once before, just once before. And you write, the specter of that slap still haunted Anna, with the odd effect of heightening her boldness in defiance of it. And I loved that line. It was like right from the start, she's bold and brave. And later in the chapter, she's told that she's strong by both Dexter Stiles and her father agrees. And so anyway, I loved how you introduce her as this strong woman early on when she's only 12 years old. So you didn't have her in mind when you started. So how did she come to you?
She just appeared. I mean, that's the most mysterious part of the process for me. I don't know who will show up. And she, I mean, I was sort of hoping for a bold female. So I was happy to find that she was there.
Yeah.
although it took me a while to get to know her, you know, because she's 19. And so what we would call really a teenager in our era.
Right.
At that time, that was really more of an adult. And you know, women were marrying at that age routinely. I think the question about Anna for a bit as I was writing her was, how quote-unquote innocent is she? You know, is she a quote-unquote good girl?
Right.
And my assumption was that she was. And that was very uncomfortable. That felt really off. And also very familiar to me in a way that is extremely unpleasant. Namely, I felt like I've sort of written about a girl like that before. I'm not interested in her. I mean, my first novel is a coming-of-age story that is in part a sexual awakening, and I did not want to tell that story again.
Okay.
I don't ever want to tell it again. I just feel with stories, I only want to tell a story once.
Yeah.
So in a way, the key to Anna's character, which was totally suggested to me by my own material, by what came up right from the start of that scene, is that she has been groomed by her father to keep secrets.
Yep.
And in a certain sense live a secret life. I mean, her life with her father is a secret life. They are, you know, he has been forced to cooperate with a group of, you know, kind of minor criminals on the Irish waterfront to feed his family, having lost all of their money in the stock market crash. And Anna is sort of his partner in crime in a way. You know, she's his companion, and she gets it without even knowing what she gets.
Right.
So once I had sort of realized that, in fact, she absolutely has the tools and the boldness to have a secret life that allows her to appear to be a quote-unquote good girl without actually being one, then she became much, much more interesting to me.
Yeah, and that is, it is so much more interesting as a reader, too, when somebody has conflict within or without, and people around her don't know who she is necessarily, but we do.
Yeah, I mean, those secret-keeping and mistaken identity, I mean, that's fun in Shakespeare.
Yeah.
And it's fun today.
Yeah.
I mean, we all love cases of mistaken identity and secret lives and, you know, mix-ups about, you know, who's who. I mean, that stuff is just fun.
Yeah, it is, definitely. One more thing about that scene before I move on. There's this great line in that scene where she and her father visit Dexter Stiles, who has a beach house, and they go out on the beach, and she takes off her shoes and socks, even though the beach is very cold. It's a cold day. And when she's asked about it, she says, it only hurts at first. After a while, you can't feel anything. And this, to me, became so important later when she becomes a diver and the equipment is horrifying. It's so heavy and painful, and she has to be able to function in it. And first, she has to sort of pass tests about whether she can wear it. So anyway, that line, I loved how that line sort of heralded what was going to be in her future.
Well, interestingly, you know, as so often seems to happen with me, a lot of this stuff just appears, and then it serves as my guide for what will come. I mean, it's not that I wrote it the first time exactly as you read it. Definitely not.
Right.
But the basic elements were all there right from the start. And that was a surprise to me because I thought the book was going to start at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which was the one thing that was sort of clearly in my mind as part of Anna's future. But lo and behold, there she was on a beach with her father and another man, and all kinds of things, you know, were suggested by that, which ended up being very important later in the book. But I myself did not know how they would be important until I got there.
Yeah. Now, and that makes it so much more interesting to read, I think, if the author is learning what's happening as she goes. But how often do you find yourself going down the wrong path because you're letting that organic process kind of take over?
Well, in the first draft, there are a lot of mishaps and mistakes that never really even feel like the wrong path exactly, because there is no path.
Right.
I'm making the path. So there will be moves that aren't quite right, and often what I find is that, first of all, I sort of forget how it was in that first draft often, because it's just such a mess and kind of just a mash of material that I'm going to use for later.
Right.
So it's hard to exactly remember, but I think often what I end up knowing the best from that first draft will be sort of big moves about when and where, but mm-hmm. I'll kind of have wrong the mood or the tone of what happens there. But again, time and place are really important. So as I'm writing, I will feel what time and place I'm working toward without even a sense of who exactly will be there or what will happen. So for example, I knew that Anna was going to get back to Manhattan Beach again.
Yeah.
And I had a feeling she was going to go there with Dexter Stiles, but I couldn't imagine why they would be together in this location again. And when that all, you know, so working toward that kind of, it was like I had an appointment with them there, but I wasn't quite sure how we were going to get there or what we were going to do when we got there. And then I had another sense of an appointment at the bottom of New York Harbor,
mm-hmm.
without saying exactly who's involved in that, because there are a lot of spoilers here.
Yeah.
And that also just seemed outrageous. Like, you're kidding. How? Why? Really? But I worked toward it, sort of feeling like, well, I really feel like this needs to happen. And actually, one kind of amazing piece of luck that I had was that, as I said, I knew very little knew nothing about diving. And I kept in my envisioning this appointment at the bottom of New York Harbor, I kept imagining these two divers talking to each other. And I thought, but that's nuts. I mean, they're inside 200-pound outfits. How the hell are they going to be talking to each other?
Yeah.
But then, in the course of my research, casually, a diver mentioned to me something that absolutely made my hair stand on end, which was that if two divers place their copper helmets adjacent to each other, they can hear each other through the metal.
Yeah.
And that was like a gift from heaven.
Yeah.
So I thought, yes, they actually can talk to each other at the bottom of New York Harbor. So there will be these big conversions that I know I'm moving toward, but then the substance of what I write in the course of getting there and even once they're there is often completely wrong. It all has to be replaced multiple times.
Okay.
But the big moves of sort of who and when and where are what I'm hoping to get out of that first draft.
You know, I have to say that in reading about the diving and the details of the dress, which is what they have to wear and the heaviness, so personally for me, this was so fascinating because my dad did some deep sea diving in South America when he was only 17. He got his mother to forge his birth certificate so he could go and do it. And they dropped him and he lost his hearing in one ear. And so, and I never really knew the details of the suits and everything. I kind of knew that it was a very different system and they had the pipe or the tube going up. But anyway, that was fascinating. To read all of this and realize it weighs 200 pounds, what you're wearing.
So in other words, they dropped him, meaning he went to the bottom fell in the water or on land?
He was working underwater, and I think that they had some sort of responsibility for his depth, and somehow that got messed up, and he got dropped too fast.
Oh, that's
in the water.
That's such a
horrible.
Screw up.
Yeah, it was a bad screw up. Anyway.
That's really, so his ear couldn't, there was a pressure problem inside his ear.
Right, and he lost mainly in one side. Anyway, that was very interesting to read about. Let's see. This book has a really interesting approach to point of view. Mostly you maintain the narratives of three people, Anna, her father Eddie, and Dexter Stiles, but you let you'll start out each chapter with a certain point of view, but then somebody else's point of view might all of a sudden be in the next scene. And then occasionally, and I love this, you give Anna's mother a tiny moment of point of view. Do you mind if I read a teeny little section?
No, please.
Okay, so this is Eddie's point of view. And he's standing with his wife, and she's diapering their adult disabled daughter. And he let go of Agnes, disappointed in himself, and she finished changing the diaper alone. She, too, had felt the pull of their old life. Turn and kiss Eddie, surprise him, forget Lydia for a moment. Where was the harm? She imagined herself doing this but could not. So that was great. You know, there's just this tiny little infusion of what is Agnes thinking here? And I wondered if you can talk a little bit about this and also about choosing to write in the third person. Nobody has the first person.
Well, I think some of those choices seem to just come along. I never considered writing this in the first person.
Yeah.
It just clearly that, I mean, with all of those craft choices, it's sort of a cost-benefit analysis. Not that I ever really get to the point of having to do the cost-benefit analysis, but, you know, you gain certain things and you lose certain things with each of those choices.
Right.
And I think I knew with this book that I wanted the gain of the possibility of omniscience and the mobility of multiple points of view, which is what you get from third person, versus the intimacy of first person, because you can get an awful lot of intimacy with third if you manipulate it correctly. So I knew that I wanted to do that. So then the question is, you know, whose point of view am I going to be looking through, and when and why? And that I had to mess around with that quite a bit.
Yeah.
There was originally more of Agnes's point of view, but the question always is, what are we really gaining by doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a gain that's sufficient to warrant this moving around? And often the answer was no with Agnes. And I think the reason for that was, in some sense, we know what Agnes is thinking.
Right.
And if we know that, then there's no reason to go into her head. And so, you know, I felt I would have been happy to go into more points of view in this book. I was very open to it, and there were times when I did it, but it felt gratuitous in that it just wasn't giving us enough to warrant that jump.
Yeah.
We had more to gain from staying where we were as readers than by moving.
Okay.
But I felt perfect license to do it. I mean, if you think about writers like Tolstoy, I mean, the 19th century writers were very agile and assured about switching points of view, and they do it in an almost crazy way sometimes that we would find radical.
Right.
So I have no qualms about doing any of that. And in Look at Me, I intersperse first person with third person. You know, and I mean, I was just pretty shameless about doing whatever I wanted. And of course, I'm sure some people would say, yeah, and it didn't work, which is always the danger. But yeah, so I was game to do anything and settled on what I felt worked best, which was mostly three points of view with jumps into other points of view whenever I felt like it and it made sense.
Right. It wasn't just Agnes. I know you also jumped into Lydia, the other daughter's point of view. She's nonverbal, so it was a little bit more interesting. You know, it was all in italics, and some of it seemed like the language that she would have. Well, she's not completely nonverbal. She'll say little things. But, you know, it seemed to be what was in her head as well as what she might be murmuring, and that was interesting too.
Yeah, well, I was sure I would go into Lydia's point of view. I knew that was going to happen because she's so much a, you know, because she is apparently nonverbal. Oh, I think she's not given credit for the degree to which she is verbal.
Right.
She becomes a kind of locus of projection for the people around her,
right.
And therefore it was very important to me to be inside her mind.
Yeah, she's sort of everybody's secret keeper. So.
Yeah, I mean, she's. You know, she's a very active and alert consciousness, but without the ability to express herself, you know, in a clear way that other people can understand. And so that is very unsettling to those around her, especially her father.
Yeah. Now, okay, let's talk a little bit about Eddie, and that's Anna and Lydia's father. So I hope you don't mind my mentioning he eventually disappears.
No, we know that pretty early in the book.
We do, yeah, and I'm not going to give any ending spoilers. But so for a long time, we don't know what happened to him, and neither does his family. But before he goes, we're given a number of things that give us so many different scenarios. So first of all, we know that he's unhappy and uncomfortable around his disabled daughter, Lydia. He wants to feel more connected to her. And he just finds it very uncomfortable. And then we also know that he thinks that maybe his family has a better time when he leaves the apartment. He thinks he hears them laughing, and what they're doing is actually dancing and laughing, and they are having fun, but it's not because they'd rather he not be there. And then, we know his work has something to do with organized crime, and that's dangerous. So anyway, there's all these different potential reasons that he might be missing. You know, maybe he took off, or maybe he was killed, or maybe, you know, who knows? So, was that a conscious process of giving us lots of potential ways for Eddie to have disappeared?
Actually, no.
No.
Because I myself did not know why Eddie had disappeared.
Oh, okay.
I, too, saw many possible ways and reasons that could have happened, but I didn't know what the answer was.
Okay.
And so, in a way, that confusion, that those questions are not smokescreens. They are actual possibilities that were working on me as they do on the reader.
Okay.
I really like it. I mean, that's generally true when I'm writing something like this. I mean, for example, with The Keep, my novel, which is a gothic thriller.
Yeah.
We know that someone, I knew that someone was going to die and someone was going to kill in that book as I was working on it, and I didn't know which character would be doing either of those things.
Yeah.
So I really, again, I think for me, in that first draft, it works best for me to be in the dark. I think then the choices feel authentic, hopefully, rather than manipulative.
Right.
They are genuine questions that are questions to me as well.
You know, your mention of The Keep reminds me of a question I had for later, but I'll bring it up now. So The Keep, my recollection, and I read that a while ago, but it has like a supernatural element to it. Right.
Well, we like a much gothic fiction, we don't know if it's supernatural or not.
Okay.
The question is always, is it internal or external?
Right.
So to
the extent that we were introduced to it as potentially supernatural at the beginning, and this reminds me of this book a little bit too, in that there's like a crime noir sort of aspect to it. And I'm just wondering, do you study genre conventions when you're moving into an area that might reflect a certain genre, even though I wouldn't call this book, you know, genre fiction, but do you study that stuff or not?
Absolutely.
You do?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you can call just reveling in a genre studying it, then I do study it. I just try to imbibe it and absorb it.
Right.
And I certainly did that with the gothic. I mean, I did nothing but read gothic fiction for about 2 years. And of course, in any of these genres, certain conventions become immediately apparent. In the gothic, the central question is almost always exactly what you pointed to, which is, there are phenomena that are difficult to explain happening here. Are they real? Meaning, are they disembodied communications of a supernatural nature? Or are they psychological?
Right.
Namely, is this person experiencing, you know, psychosis of some sort?
Right.
That's almost always the question in gothic fiction. And that dates back to Anne Radcliffe, you know, and it's true of Henry James, and you know, more recent gothic writers. With the noir, the conventions are more, I guess, kind of stylistic in a way. There's just an urban kind of shadowy feeling to it that
yeah.
is just super fun, and a vague sense of possible dread or mishap that I liked.
Yeah.
And a kind of sexiness. And a sort of snappy mode of dialogue that I liked to avail myself of, you know, as just a way of animating conversation and a way of finding a vocabulary for conversation that was happening outside of my lifetime.
Yeah.
It just felt like one more dimension to use without really limiting me at all.
Yeah. I really noticed that in the nightclub in particular, like the dialogue in the nightclub. I don't know. It became very cinematographic to me. Like I could suddenly just see Nell, who's this character in the book. And, you know, she's kind of like sliding into the place and saying, "Hey, Charlie," you know, I don't know. I can't do it. But it just really felt very familiar to me because of that sort of convention.
Well, in a way, that's very, you know, a very fair association because, of course, there are just endless nightclub scenes in movies of
yes.
the time. And in a way, how could I not hearken to those?
Right.
Because we've all seen them. It's crazy to pretend we haven't. And fun to acknowledge that we have.
Yeah.
As long as I'm not limited by it, I'm very happy to avail myself of any genre. And I mean, another genre I was thinking a lot about in this book is the sea story. Because
yeah.
there is a whole sea element to this. And there's a huge literature of the sea. I mean, it's massive. And there's no way, I mean, it was important to be familiar with that literature and to be aware of the fact that I was entering into not a genre per se, because these stories can be written in all kinds of ways, but a kind of maritime tradition in literature that is strong and fierce.
Yeah.
And so I tried to do that responsibly.
Yeah, it was really fun to read. Now, I want to, in talking about like that snappy dialogue in the nightclub, I also just want to mention how your prose just It just is so much fun to read. You know, you'll have that sort of thing. And then there's just this beautiful prose. Like, do you mind if I read another little bit?
No, not at all.
So this is a scene in which Anna and her mother are bathing Lydia, who I think has cerebral palsy. Would you say that's what you were thinking of?
Probably. I don't like to diagnose characters.
Okay.
Exactly. I mean, I often have characters with mental, you might say, you know, mental health issues.
Right.
But I, you know, we know it happened at birth and that it's not genetic. And I think it's very possible that it is cerebral palsy.
Yeah. Okay. So, her hands are kind of tightly clasped against her will and things like that. So anyway, this is just a scene where they're bathing Lydia. Released from gravity, her coiled bent form luxuriated visibly. Their mother held her under the arms while Anna massaged her scalp and hair with the special lilac shampoo. Lydia's clear blue eyes gazed at them rapturously. And then a little while later, it took both Anna and her mother to lift Lydia back out before the water cooled, bubbles gleaming on the unexpected twists of her body, beautiful in its strange way, like the inside of an ear. I just loved that so much.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it was so beautiful. And I don't ever think about the inside of an ear, but it was perfect. So...
Well, that actually, it's funny. That is a phrase that came to me. I think that lasted all the way from the first draft. So that's a rare turn of phrase that made it through the, you know, I don't know, 40 iterations in between.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was great. I just, yeah, that really jumped out.
Thank you.
And I'm just going to jump in and say you're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And this is an interview with Jennifer Egan. If you're enjoying the show, please consider liking it on Facebook, rating it in iTunes, or tweeting about Write the Book. Thanks so much. Stay tuned for the rest of the interview. Let's talk a little bit. Okay, so I want to just mention another scene. There's this great moment where, so Eddie has this friend who he rescued from drowning at one point. And there's this moment where... you recount that rescue very briefly. He rescues two people, in fact, from a riptide, and he shouts, "Stop fighting, float, and let the tide pull us out." And then a little while later, we hear his advice about the syndicate. He says, "Keep him satisfied, then look for a way out." And I was like, oh, that's such a great juxtaposition. So from like the craft perspective, as far as like drawing metaphors into what you're writing about, can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, some of that happens kind of naturally. I mean, first of all, anything having to do with the sea is sort of amazing because it's sort of metaphorical and literal always, both at the same time.
Mm.
And I think that was very interesting to me.
Yeah.
You know, so much metaphor already involves the sea. And even when you talk literally about the sea, it sort of sounds metaphorical. So it's this strange realm of language, which is sort of everything at once. You know, it's hard to remember, like, I knew from the beginning that this rescue had happened. That was another one of those things that occurred right in the first draft. In the characterization, I mean, there's so many characters in this book with such different lives. So it was really important for me, and I think kind of for the reader, to seize on a certain architecture of an individual relationship and to feel that working through the narrative. Because I didn't have time to flesh all of this out. I mean, the book would have been, you know, 9,000 pages long.
Right.
So in the case of Eddie and Donellan, the kid he rescues who goes on to be his boss,
right,
on the Irish waterfront, and not a very nice boss either,
right,
you know, the trick was to sort of feel how that rescue works through all of their relations that follow. And so in a sense, you know, that's kind of how it works with these sorts of relationships. Something literal becomes figurative as it acts on us in our lives. And in a way, that's how trauma works. I mean, this is real stuff. You know,
yeah.
Something happens and it acts upon us symbolically for the rest of our lives. We all know that, and we all have those things. Sometimes its impact is so troublesome and debilitating that we really have to address it as a problem. But sometimes it's just about a kind of calcification of a certain sort of relationship that and this is how it often true with family, that we have to sort of work against the rest of our lives or be doomed to repeat it. And either way, it's still acting on us.
Yeah.
So in the case of Eddie and Donellan, you know, Eddie rescued Donellan. Donellan knows that he owes Eddie his life. He hates being in debt to Eddie. So he treats him poorly as his boss, and yet he also, in a certain sense, saved Eddie's family by giving him the job in the first place when Eddie lost all of his money. Eddie is enraged with Donellan for the fact that Donellan treats him badly, even though Eddie saved his life. And yet, Eddie's tremendously grateful to Donellan because he knows that Donellan will always take care of him.
Right.
So all of that is going on, and in a certain way, it all originates from this rescue.
Right, and it just makes so much sense to let that rescue be the structure of what happens between them in the future.
And it keeps going. I mean, again, yeah. Without spoilers,
right.
You know, this is not just history. This dynamic between them is crucial to the plot of the book.
Yeah.
I mean, it continues, and Eddie ends up making some very bold choices that surprise himself because of the deep, intimate interweaving of his life with Donellan's.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about how you keep us aware of war in this book. And I was struck, actually, there were several pages in a row where something came up about wars, and I realized that, you know, Eddie is exposed to the Civil War through a man that he knows as a boy, Mr. Devere. And then Anna is sort of exposed to the Great War by way of her neighbor who had a shrapnel wound that will never heal. His name is Mr. Gratzky. And so World War I exists in that story. And then, of course, the book takes place during World War II. So this lineup of wars, this connection of all the wars was really interesting to think about as I was reading and to think about from the perspective of, you know, being alive during that time period and seeing why people were just sort of like much more, not positive about the war, but supportive of their soldiers. And it was just sort of this line of, I don't know, fate. So I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think, I mean, in a way, we too are defined by
yeah.
which wars we've experienced.
Right.
You know, people who were adults when the Vietnam War happened, you know, remember that time in a different way from people who were not.
Right.
People who lived in New York when 9/11 happened probably think about that differently from people who didn't. So I do think a war, even though there hasn't been a war that our culture has united around in the way that America did around World War II. You know, even though that hasn't exactly happened, wars really are events that sort of define us generationally.
Right.
And so in a way, you know, one aspect of historical research that was so much more complex than I anticipated was the necessity of not just understanding what the present is at a particular time, like what people were wearing and what was actually going on in the present day war. I mean, those questions are the easiest to answer, especially with the internet.
Right.
You can spend a week and basically know it all.
Yeah.
But the bigger question is like, what are people remembering? What is the past in that present? And of course, the past is different for everyone depending on how old they are and which wars and other things they're thinking about. Those were the really important questions. And so, you know, wars were the previous wars were among many factors that I had to think about impacting on my present in the book, which is the 30s and 40s. I mean, what about the 1920s? What about the stock market crash? How did all of that live on in the collective consciousness? Those were questions that were subtler and more interesting, but also much more challenging to answer. And I think without having a sense of that bedrock of the past in each person's individual history and then working together as people unite around a present moment,
mm-hmm.
without all of that, the book would be very thin. I think the texture would be very thin, and the psychology would be. I mean,
yeah.
that's where it all happens. It's, you know, the present moment is all of us bringing our individual pasts to bear on events as they unfold. if all you have is the events as they unfold, you've got nothing.
Yeah. That's so interesting. Yeah, that's true. And so you've talked a bit about your research. It must have been an enormous undertaking. Are you mostly on the internet to do your research, or are you reading lots and lots of books?
I was least on the internet. Okay. The internet didn't have much to offer me with this. It just, you know, I mean, again, it was helpful for certain surface things. But I would say that my research took many forms, and I approached it very journalistically. And I'm lucky that I have a longstanding relationship with the New York Times Magazine, writing very in-depth research pieces that have required processing an enormous amount of information, mm-hmm. and kind of synthesizing that along with human stories. So in a way, I was sort of trained to do this kind of research over many years, and I'm very grateful for that training. Some of it was absolutely archival research, but even then, the internet didn't have a lot to offer me except to help me find out-of-print books, you know, librarians who could help me find books that I couldn't even get to in physical form, but that they were ultimately able to send me PDFs of, you know, so actual very arcane areas of technical knowledge that were represented in books. I remember sometimes on the elliptical machine at the gym reading books that really raised eyebrows from the people around me, these tiny, you know, The Merchant Marine Officer's Handbook from 1942 with tiny print. You know, I mean, books about lifeboat survival. As I, you know, cushily pumping away at Crunch Gym. You know, it was a very sort of a culture clash there. So anyway, so arcane technical knowledge as represented in books. Then, of course, this period is you know, present in living memory. So I did as many interviews as I possibly could, and I started doing them, luckily, around 2005, when people who were then in their 80s were available and happy to talk.
Right, and had their memories.
Yeah, and are no longer with us, a number of them.
Oh.
So lots of those interviews. Some of them formalized. I collaborated with the Brooklyn Navy Yard and the Brooklyn Historical Society on an oral history project to interview every living person we could find who had ever worked at the Brooklyn Navy Yard.
Wow.
And so I, you know, I was more interested, obviously, in the interviews with people who had worked there during the war. And it wasn't just the ladies. I mean, there were some amazing interviews. One gentleman who had grown up next to the Navy Yard and was in his 80s when we spoke to him sometime before 2010 made me a hand-drawn map of the area.
Oh, wow.
And that was crucial because the entire area was leveled and has been replaced with a housing project. So there, even the street grid is gone.
Oh, wow.
And he was drawing in not only these little these knotted up little streets, but individual businesses on the streets. I mean, it was priceless. So those interviews were fabulous. And I also spoke with merchant mariners who sailed on Liberty ships during the war, some amazing encounters with people. Then there was just time spent among artifacts. And I would include my many visits to the Jeremiah O'Brien, which is actually a functional Liberty ship that still is docked in San Francisco. I would include that in that category. You know, wearing the Mark V diving dress, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then there was also something in between interviewing living people and the sort of more dry archival research, which was immersing myself in letters, correspondences, and also in oral histories conducted with people who were no longer living. And those were just sensational. And it really left me with such a gratitude to the field of oral history, which I think is really growing. And I just feel, you know, we getting these stories down is so crucial. It's so splendid for the researcher who comes upon them later.
Yeah.
So there was a, it was multifaceted, and always thrilling to do this research.
There's this one tiny little detail. There were thousands and thousands of these, but there was this one tiny detail that jumped out at me. And there's this mention of a chocolate factory that changed to making a chocolate cousin for soldiers, which smells good but tastes like a boiled potato. And I'm like, where did she find that? How do you know that?
Well, you know, that was actually, I found that in a funny way. Even though I knew the Brooklyn Navy Yard pretty well, they, after Building 92 was built, which is their exhibit space, and I ended up being on the advisory board of that project, that's how deep I got into matters Navy Yard. They began doing tours of the Navy Yard. So I went on a tour, and it was during that tour that I learned about the chocolate factory making that particular kind of chocolate. I had heard, see, I did so much research that sometimes research would start to intersect. Yeah. Different stories would intersect, and that was really exciting. I remember hearing from maybe it was the gentleman who drew me the map. Someone who knew the neighborhood well had mentioned that the air often smelled like chocolate, and they weren't sure why.
Oh.
And I thought, well, that's interesting. And then on this tour, I learned that there was this chocolate factory that was making something like chocolate that was actually really for soldier survival. And then actually when I looked in the National Archives, I looked at really hundreds of photographs of the Navy Yard that were taken for engineering purposes. So basically it was just pictures of pipes and, you know, other incredibly pedestrian, nitty-gritty nuts and bolts sort of work that was being done at the Navy Yard. But in the background, you can see buildings, streets,
okay,
and all kinds of things that interested me. And in one of those, on Flushing Avenue, there was a picture of the chocolate factory in the background. So it all came together. And I was especially eager to include details of elements that had popped up in more than one story.
Yeah.
At that point, a kind of coalescing began to happen, and I began to really understand what sorts of textures were present enough that they were available to multiple individuals.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the scenes where Anna becomes a diver are some of my favorites, because she has to go through a series of tests, and the person who's in charge really doesn't want her to do it. And she has to overcome a lot of prejudice. And at first I sort of almost understood this guy's reluctance. I think Lieutenant Axel, is that his name?
Yeah.
In case she might simply, you know, not be strong enough to wear the equipment or whatever, you know. But once she proves herself, it just becomes infuriating. And these are such great scenes. And I wondered if you got upset writing them. Like, did you have to hold yourself back from helping her too much too soon, for example?
My concerns were not so much about helping her, but about avoiding cliche. I knew there's such a temptation to see the underdog triumph. I mean, that's such a common literary trope or just storytelling trope. And I really did not want that to happen, especially because I thought it was really unrealistic that it would happen.
Right.
I knew that, you know, having clearing a hurdle would not cause her to be celebrated with open arms. It would ratchet up the anger at her.
Right.
I just knew that instinctively. And also, I had spent a lot of time talking to a woman who was the first Army diver. And P.S., she was diving, I believe, in the 80s.
Oh, wow.
Maybe the late 70s. I should double check that. Anyway, so, you know, and she confronted unbelievable prejudice, and
right,
it really ended her diving career. So, you know, 40 years later, that was going on. So it's just, while I wanted the payoff for Anna of everyone loving her and agreeing that she was wonderful, that was the last thing that could happen.
Right.
It's the last thing that would happen. You know, prejudice doesn't go away when someone proves themselves. Prejudice often is intensified by seeing that the object of prejudice prove him or herself.
Right. Yeah.
And I wanted to be true to that and not make it a kind of happy, you know, movie-esque story about triumphing over difficult odds. That's not really how it works in the real world.
Well, you know, and another thing that really occurred to me while I was reading this, just how much this time period affected women, and women were given work that wasn't the norm before the war, but because the men were all gone, they were given this work. And then when the war was over, that would have changed. And it just sort of struck me that this really paved the way for post-war women's rights movement.
Oh, for sure. I mean, there was no way to put the genie back in the bottle. And although everyone tried, including the women, I don't want to make blanket generalizations, but I think there was a baby boom, as we all know, and a move back toward domesticity that was championed in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
But there was just no way to repress what had begun. And I had poignant conversations with women who tried to continue doing the work that they had done at the Navy Yard. A group of welders in particular who were really awfully good at the work they did and tried to, you know, get work after the war doing that. They had to work. They were working class families and needed that second income, and they were just laughed out of town. There was absolutely no way to be hired to do this work that they had become so good at. You know, that's tough.
Yeah.
And I think as a sort of collective psychology, that was just not going to work forever. So even though these particular women were not the ones who, on the whole, enacted the women's movement, it was really their children, that those seeds had been sown. And of course, my character is a little different in that she, without creating spoilers, you know, she finds a way to make use of the mobility and the confusion and the jumbling of the war,
right,
in ways that many women did not or didn't have to. One thing that really came through in a lot of my reading that I hadn't thought about, I guess my awareness of it started with fiction. I was reading Jack Kerouac's first novel, The City and the Country, I think mm-hmm. it's called. And he writes it's a very autobiographical novel, but he writes powerfully about the sheer movement that happened during the war. Just the train stations just crammed with people, you know, men moving for various reasons, women going with them or moving for their own reasons. There was a huge migration out to the West Coast where industry flourished. And, you know, that kind of migration was really an important aspect of the war that I had not actually thought about. That was something I don't think I even knew about it, actually.
Yeah.
And so that was something that I also was interested in, or I was happy to see represented in this book to some degree. There's
yeah.
a lot of movement among these characters as well.
Yeah. Now, we haven't talked a lot about Dexter yet, and we're kind of winding down on time, but I do want to just ask you, it's very interesting to me that both Dexter Stiles and Anna have interactions with gangsters in their youth that will sort of eventually change their lives, and these interactions affect them profoundly. And, you know, we were talking before about how conflict, internal or external, is so interesting, but also parallel lives or parallel experiences. And I found that one really fun to read about. So can you talk a little bit about this?
Sure. I mean, I think one thing to mention is that the gangster had a sort of different association then, let's say, than it does now. You know, because of Prohibition, gangsters were pretty cool. And you know, gangsters became the controllers of the liquor industry, which remained extremely active during Prohibition. So, you know, Dexter Stiles is drawn to the world of gangsters as really a means to upward mobility. I mean, he's the son of a kind of overworked cook initially at one of the big Manhattan Beach hotels. But Dexter is aware of this sort of secret world, which he can't quite understand, but in which people seem to be doing things that don't quite make sense. And it turns out that those things are things like payoffs and protection money and the various things that happen in a world that has an organized crime element.
Yeah, there's this great section. He's drawn to them, and you write, a smoldering of dim feeling behind their eyes, a heaviness to their hands, and when they gave him a pat or a swat, he curried their favor. It goes on, and then I loved this. Later, when the men who fought the Great War returned, Dexter recognized in their fractured gazes and somnolent movements something of what he'd first admired in Mr. Q's men. By then, he knew what it meant, intimacy with violence. So that says a lot about his character, too, that he's sort of attracted to this intimacy with violence.
Absolutely. I mean, I think part of it, I mean, there it's interesting to read about organized crime at that time and how much known underworld figures hung out and lived in proximity to, you know, upstanding citizens.
Right.
You know, there was a guy named Frank Costello who was a crime boss in New York, a big crime boss, and he lived in a fancy building along Central Park, and everyone knew who he was, and his children knew their children. So that's a little different from nowadays. And I think as far as I can understand it, Prohibition was largely the reason for that. The gangster became a sort of hero because the gangster was providing alcohol to a culture that still wanted it.
Right.
And organized crime became much more organized during Prohibition, much more national, much more corporate. These groups had to work together to really do their job efficiently and profitably. So Dexter ends up in the world of organized crime at the sort of perfect time, just as Prohibition is beginning. And it becomes, for him, a means to wealth, fame, upward mobility, marriage to a fabulous, you know, wealthy, blue-blooded girl. So he gets a lot out of it. But one thing that he doesn't quite understand is that the fact that he's living his life amidst and alongside upstanding citizens does not mean that he is ever regarded as one himself.
Right, right.
And I guess that's that blind spot where we sometimes have trouble seeing ourselves as others see us. And that becomes a problem for him.
It's so interesting how the war is what points that out to him, that he is not somebody making a contribution. He's just somebody who's reaping the rewards of his position in a way.
Yeah, and patriotism was real, even among mobsters. I mean, I refer in the book to Lucky Luciano making a deal with the federal government. Well, that really happened, and he was ultimately released from prison and allowed to return to Italy for that. So there was patriotism, even among gangsters. But the question was what to do with it. Dexter has a strong idea about what to do with it, but that idea is not welcomed by his superiors. And so it becomes, you know, there is, as in all realms of life, there's a movement and a shuffling that happened during the war. And so it was interesting to imagine that in this particular world of gangsters. Do I really know that things unfolded that way? No, I'm just imagining. But I feel like I learned enough to imagine with a kind of confidence.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask if you're writing anything. I'm assuming you finished this book quite a while ago since it's out now. So are you writing anything now, or do you know what time and place you're going to be writing about next?
I think that as I was working on this first draft, I was also working on another first draft because I wanted to try to avoid having such a long gap between books. I'm hoping that my next one will be actually a companion to Goon Squad, following some of the same some peripheral characters into other worlds.
Oh, cool.
But the question is, you know, what it will be like. It can't just be an echo of Goon Squad. It has to really be its own thing. And very different, but using some of the same principles. That's my wild hope. Can I do it? Will it be good? Those things I never know, but that's what I'm going to try to do.
Okay, great. And then the other question I always ask guests is, what have you been reading lately that you might recommend to people who are listening?
I've been reading, well, first of all, I would just say I loved Lincoln and the Bardo, George Saunders' book.
Yeah.
It's a historical novel also, and we had a conversation in the New York Times Magazine together about our historical writing projects before they both came out. So it was amazing to read his, which I just think is a flat-out masterpiece.
And it's his first novel, right?
Yes, yeah. First novel. It's absolutely loony. There are no rules, and yet he establishes his own wacky rules that let you move through the text, you know, without, in my case, a sense of total disorientation. There's a lot of real history there, but there's also a lot of madness and invention, and I just think it's absolutely marvelous. And I guess the two other things I would say, well, I loved Zadie Smith's novel, Swing Time.
Okay.
It's amazing to me. It's interesting that there's sort of a trend toward writing about female friendship. Certainly, Elena Ferrante
Yeah.
has, been one of the avatars of that. I actually preferred Swing Time. I found it more interesting than Ferrante on female friendship, and I highly recommend it.
Okay.
And then just going back a little, I'm really immersed in Trollope right now.
Oh.
Trollope is all about power and money. So anyone who wants to sort of reflect on our times and how little things have changed since the mid-19th century,
Yeah.
I recommend Trollope. The characters arrive on the scene with a price tag on their heads, literally. I mean, it's delicious. I think Trollope is underread in this country because he's very, very relevant to our times.
Great. I have one last question for you. I hope it's not too big a question for the time we have left, but I want to just read a little exchange between Anna and her aunt, whose name is Brienne. Anna says, "I'm hoping to sell you a war bond." And her aunt says, "Certainly, when pigs fly." "We're behind Philadelphia and Charleston. Mama won't let me join the 10% club." "She's speaking war," Brienne remarked to Anna's mother, who was feeding Lydia. "I'm afraid I'm unfamiliar with that tongue." "She'd like to be paid 10% of her wages in war bonds," her mother said flatly. She and Anna had hardly spoken in hours. So anyway, my question isn't substantive, but more about writing dialogue. It's just you have great dialogue. There's another great scene of dialogue, which is sort of banter while Anna is being dressed in the diving suit for the first time, and the tenders who help her have this fantastic banter going back and forth, which is very teasing and mean, but nobody's taking offense. It's a funny scene. But so I'm just wondering if you have advice for writers about writing dialogue.
Well, let's see. I think I learned a lot about dialogue from Don DeLillo. And the thing that he does that's so good is that, and what I think we often do, is that no one, you often people are not responding to the thing that was just said. In a certain sense, dialogue, often on the page, it's written as a back and forth, a sort of tennis game, but that's often not how it actually happens. Often, conversations are sort of happening in parallel. And if people are responding to each other, they're often responding to the thing the person said a couple of lines ago, not the immediate thing that was just said. I guess what I'm really saying is that dialogue is sloppy. It's messy. Often people are talking to themselves more than they are to each other. They repeat themselves a lot. And so I'm always trying to capture that sense of, personal agendas and self-involvement, which is, a mainstay of dialogue, and not let it fall into this sort of over-considerate back and forth in which everyone is responding to each other, because for better or worse, that's just not how we talk. And if it feels too linear and too, back and forth, it's really dead for me. It doesn't, there's no life in that. And so it's not that I don't write dialogue like that. I do, but then I fix it. I get rid of it, or I mix it up. I just try to find ways to make it more, just more lively and and more sort of sparkly. And I think that I mean, in general, as a fiction writer, my goal is to do as many things as possible at one time. And if those things can be mutually exclusive and yet coexist, so much the better. And that holds true for dialogue too. That's like a basic principle of mine.
Okay. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. That's great. And thank you for talking to me. I just want to mention again, the novel is Manhattan Beach, published by Scribner, written by Jennifer Egan. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with the author Jennifer Egan. You can learn more about her work at her website, jenniferegan.com. So this week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by Jennifer Egan, who, as you just heard in the interview, discovers her story as she writes it. She only knows really the time and the place that the story is in when she begins. So this prompt is very much in keeping with that approach. She suggests, write without knowing what you are writing, cover the screen of your laptop, and write continuously for 15 minutes. Print and read. Voila. So good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. Next week on Write the Book, I will speak with Swiss author Peter Stamm. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. Actually, it might just be under Write the Book. I think we've changed that to Write the Book on Facebook. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com, or if you know how to spell my name, ShaylaConnorShapiro.com. But it's hard to spell, so She Laughs Without Us is another one that will take you there. If you have a guest to suggest, or comments about the show, or news about book-related events, you can send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And if you like the show, again, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. So that's the week. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3, WBTV.org. Have a great week.